I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Jonathan Goldstein, and you're listening to Wiretap on CBC Radio 1. Today's episode, Rebirth.
When I left, I had no plan of being gone this long. I just sort of had this sense that the world was so much bigger than, like, our little corner of it, really.
This is Emily Richmond. For the past 4 years, she's been sailing around the world on a tiny boat by herself. During that time, she's been to a dozen countries on 4 continents, and she's docked at countless ports. I spoke with her via Skype on her last night in Borneo, where she was hiding out from the rain before setting sail again the next morning.
I tend to stay in places like at least a month or two. So I've like had all these different boyfriends in different places, like, you know, boyfriends named like Turtle Eyes and named after like spirit guides and stuff like that. And that becomes your life when you're there. Like you hunt for your food, or you dive and spearfish and ride horses. And like, I mean, literally from month to month, everything about your life changes.
Speaking to Emily, you get the sense that in these past few years, she has lived dozens and dozens of lives. With each port, she's offered a chance to start fresh, to be reborn onto the shores of a land where no one knows her. But there was one place Emily landed where her rebirth transcended the myth of the traveler and suddenly became something more literal. While sailing around Papua New Guinea, Emily stumbled upon a cargo cult. A cargo cult is a religious movement which arises in certain isolated tribal societies. After having sudden contact with modern technology, these groups form, believing cargo to be bestowed from a supernatural source. And when Emily arrived at the shores of this particular tribe, she was greeted by a huge welcoming ceremony.
People were coming out to meet in the road, putting these sort of floral necklaces with, you know, really large shells around my neck. And they have this sort of like spiritual leader who I guess had visions that I was coming before I got there. And so this woman, the spiritual leader, she grabbed me and was like wrestling me to the ground, and they were shoving all this money at me. And like, I had no idea what was going on at the time, but like the next day they explained to me the entire doctrine, which is that according to them, when they die, they will be reborn with white skin. They think that their ordinary skin is sort of like peeled away, and underneath they have white skin. So they said, when you arrive in the village, the first person in years with white skin, of course, immediately they're thinking, this is our ancestor. This is our ancestor returned to sort of like bring on the great change, to bring us wealth, to bring us prosperity.
Did you consider just embracing it at a certain point, just settling into this great new life of being worshipped?
Not at all, no. They're just putting all their hopes in you, really, you know, like they're hoping that, you know, like these people are so impoverished, like, you know, at certain years, if the crops don't come up, they've got very little food. And to have somebody place all of their like hopes and expectations on you, God, that's an enormous burden, especially if you've got no prospect of actually delivering on it.
We think of rebirth as a fresh new start. But whether you're entering the world for the first time or the second time, you're always born into the expectations of the people that surround you. Emily only stayed with the tribe a few days before she moved on once again, recommencing her cycle of reinvention, of arrival and departure.
It's always difficult to leave, like I'm leaving right now, and right before you called, like, there was like a stream of people coming by to say goodbyes. Yeah, it's always hard, you know? Like, you don't know when you're going to see people again, or if you're ever going to see them again. And mixed with, like, the sort of emotional, like, impact of going out to sea where everything is completely unknown, everything's variable. Like, it's a huge risk to sort of like toss off your dock lines and go out into the unknown.
Hi, my name is Steve Callahan, and in 1982, I was lost at sea for 2.5 months.
Steve Callahan also found rebirth at sea, but only after facing death. When he was a young man, not yet 30, Steve's marriage fell apart, and he was adrift. Fed up with the pressures and disappointments of human connection, he fled across the Atlantic in a small sailboat in search of freedom and adventure. After a few months, sailing around Europe and the western coast of Africa, Steve headed out into open waters once more for his return journey home.
I sailed out about a week or so and was having a pretty decent time of it, actually, although the weather was getting pretty rough. And the night of February 4th, 1982, something hit the side of the boat at night. I always presumed it was a whale, but it could have been a shark or some big creature, maybe a sea monster, who knows. There's a big bam in the side of the boat, and a lot of water rushed in, sinking the boat very, very quickly. It was filling up with water. I leapt up and grabbed all my emergency gear, got up on the deck and inflated the life raft, and bailed out just before morning and went drifting off with the winds and the currents. Frankly, I thought my chances of survival were almost nil because I was pretty much dead smack in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, which meant that I was weeks away from the shipping lanes, even where I would have my first real chance of getting picked up, and I had nowhere near enough water in order to get that far. So there were times where I felt in my most desperate moments that, well, here I am, I'm going to die, and nobody's ever going to know what happened to me. So it was a really, really depressing time, and it lasted about 2 weeks, which was the period of time it took me to learn how to produce water, catch food, you know, get familiar with the raft, and slowly that evolves into basically living like an aquatic caveman. I live primarily off of a species called Dorado or Dorad because a school started forming around the raft within a few days. They use the raft as a kind of rendezvous point, and they proved to be very smart and capable. The spear gun that I used to catch the fish was a really small spear gun, almost a bit of a toy, and it wasn't really made for catching these large fish, and they would pull the shaft of the spear out and break it. So every time I put it back together and made it a little bit better was a great day. Basically the entire experience of survival is like life, but in extremes. The lows are incredibly low and the highs are incredibly high. You know, you have a little failure that in normal life wouldn't make any difference, but it could kill you out there. So it's really depressing. On the other hand, producing in just a little bit of water, just enough to drink, say, or something like that, it was this huge moment of elation. So it's very volatile emotionally because there's no backup. Anything can go wrong and kill you at any moment. But there were many things I saw that were beautiful. And in fact, there's a passage in the little log that I kept. I scribbled on these bits of paper, and it was after some particularly spectacular night, you know, amazing stars, and looking out and seeing all the Dorado around the raft, like little silver platters hovering under the raft because, you know, there's all this bioluminescence in the ocean. Anything that goes through it creates all these, like, billions of teeny, teeny fireflies and just amazing stuff. And I wrote, you know, well, this is a view of heaven from a seat in hell. It was not a pleasant place to be. It was a horrible place to be. But there were really amazing things that I witnessed through going through it.
He You wrote in your log at sea, "I have lost all but my past, my friends, and of course the shirt off my back. Ho ho, will I make it? I don't know." Was there anything in a kind of perverse way liberating about having lost everything, all of your possessions, when your ship went down?
You know, when you lose everything and your life is really on the edge, you're given an incredible gift, which is a clarity about what really is important in life. And it really clarified for me all my weaknesses. At 30 years old, I was actually physically in pretty decent shape, as good as I could be. But my weaknesses really were in dealing with people and humanity. I was very, very self-protective, and it was kind of more of a self-centered existence. And it took going through that experience to really figure out that I needed people a lot more than I thought I did, that I was no sea creature, that somehow I had to come back and make a more meaningful life where relationships and people were a bigger part of it than they had been. After 2.5 months, I did actually pilot my way across the Atlantic, and I ended up about 60 miles south of where initially I was headed. And when I first landed, I was born. It was like literally being reborn, like a baby, in terms of, you know, colors and sounds and things were like I'd experienced them for the first time. And, you know, it's like all my senses were stuck into an electric socket or something or other. It was just like everything was highlighted. But then I also was very naive again about people. I had over-romanticized people. And I guess over the years, what I've come to grips with is that despite the fact that we can be selfish and all these things, there's also our capacity to have compassion and be generous and be kind. And that really is something that has changed my life a great deal. I have healthier relationships, and there's a bit more feeling of connection to other people and purpose in life.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
If I had the choice, I would choose to be reborn as a turtle, as it floats through the depths of deep, soft water.
Oh yeah? Is that's what you'd like to be reborn as a turtle?
Well, first of all, if I was reincarnated into a dragonfly, I wouldn't find that very fun, because they only live 2 days, and then, like, oh, I have to die now again. But...
yeah.
A turtle can live over 200 years.
So it's about quantity as much as quality for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let me ask you this. Would you rather go to some beautiful afterlife, or would you rather be reborn and live different lives over and over and over again forever?
I'd choose to be reincarnated, because I think then you could see all the different facets of life from a different point of view. If the heavenly afterlife is sitting on a cloud all day and eating grapes and looking like Caesar, I don't really feel like it.
You think it would be boring?
Yeah. I seriously find no appeal to being dead.
So do you think that's why people like the idea of reincarnation? Because they get to avoid death?
Well, partly that. But I also think that people want the idea of a second chance.
How do you mean?
Like, who knows what mistakes you made, or if you're a selfish person, or if you're a bad person, or if you're mean, or a bully, or something like that, and it's super nice to have a chance to fix that. And if in my next life I could change anything I wanted to, I'd want to be a better sister.
Oh yeah? How so?
Well, I don't know if you noticed, but like sisters and brothers just kind of fight. And I sometimes just say to myself, I don't really need to be exceedingly generous with my sister because she's your sister and you see her every day. And
yeah.
I don't think that's very nice. And who knows? I mean, if my sister died today or tomorrow,
God forbid,
then I would be sad that I hadn't been nice to her before that.
What keeps you from doing that now? Like just being nicer to your sister now in this life?
Well, it's kind of difficult to imagine that someone could completely start over, because if you've lived the same way for who knows how many years, it's difficult to change the way you were. So it just seems so much easier to wait till your next life.
Mm-hmm.
But for all we know, we only get one chance. Maybe there is no rebirth. Maybe there's just birth, and we have to make do with that.
After a long, terrible struggle in their cave near the clearing in the trees, Grub and Thack held their newborn. She had a hairy, protruding forehead like her father, Grub, and good, strong lungs like her mother, Thack. Grub chewed through the cord that connected the baby to Thack, and as he did, he thought, "How do these bloody, screaming things get into a woman's belly?" Later that night, by the fire, Grub tried to remember where he was before he came out of his mother's belly. Grub could remember yesterday and the day before that, all the way back to a time when tiny Grub was sitting on a rock, watching a furry animal flee the thwacks of his club, his first memory of being alive. But before that, nothing. He thought and thought, and trying to think so hard hurt his head, and still, nothing came. He asked others where they were before they came out, but no one could remember. They told stories, though. "There is a place behind the large hills," said Ak, "where the babies are stacked before they come." "Babies come from great snake," said Gar. "Woman meets snake in dreams." Gar spent most of his time falling from trees, and Ak walked around with three fingers in his mouth. Grub did not trust either of them. Grub needed to know the secret because he wanted to have more babies. His neighbor, Ruk, had about 10. Atok, Par, Gog, Ta, Ruk Jr., Fog. There were so many he couldn't keep track. They were hardy children, too. One two-year-old had a beard almost as thick as Grub's. And altogether, these mighty children raced up and down Grub's rock pile, stealing rocks, and even though he shook his great stick, he could not stop them. Grub saw that more babies was better, and he wanted as many as Ruk. Many more little hims and hers to scatter around and steal rocks for him. But he was stuck at just one. Why was he stuck? Thack saw Grub was sad, and she did not want him to be sad. She wanted him to be happy for one baby, which was something, not nothing. She told him to go ahead and give the baby a name. "Gag," Grub said. Gag was his mother's name, or maybe his father's. He was not sure. He'd not seen either in a long time. Gag and other Gag had both died long, long ago. While gathering fruit, they had been stepped on by mammoths. The days passed, and Grubb thought about the problem of how to make more babies all the time. He made offerings, throwing rocks and melon rinds at the moon. If he could only hit it, he'd think, maybe he could shake the moon loose of its babies. It was possible. Anything was. After he made his offerings, he returned to Thak and put his arms around her waist to see if her belly was getting bigger. He kept his hands around her all night, but could feel no growth. Thak did not want Grubb to be sad. So every time there was a rumble in her stomach she thought might mean a baby had come, she would run to tell him. She'd point at her middle, and he would lay her on the ground, placing his cheek to her stomach and listening for hours. But it was never a baby. It was always just frogs. Frogs gave Thak indigestion. Was it connected to the lightning somehow? The forms he saw in the clouds? The plants Thak ate? Should he dance in the big fire? Scream at the big tree? The medium tree? Beg old fat man in the sky? Make Thak squat over the fire while he cooked a fish? Could he get a baby in him? He'd not ever seen a baby in a man, but maybe he could be the first. Did the ostrich dance make a baby? The alligator dance? Licking trees? Licking belly? He sometimes dreamed of babies. Maybe he had to pluck one out of his dreams and stick it into Thak's belly. But he always woke up before he could. Was it mangoes? His neighbor, Ruck, ate a lot of them. The pits piled high outside his cave door. Grubb tried it and ate so many he made himself ill. He threw up and rubbed the mango that came out onto Thak's stomach. One is good, said Thak. One not good, said Grubb. How could one be good when Ruck had 10? After a useless day of dancing, screaming, and throwing things at the sky, Grubb came home to the cave. It was getting dark, and Grubb was sad. Thak did not want him to be sad. She wore her good summer warthog pelt to cheer him up. It gave Grubb ideas. Thok Thok? He asked, hopefully. Thok Thok, answered Thak. They laid themselves down upon the earth, and Thak took Grubb into her arms and offered him the comfort of warm, hidden places. The next morning, Grubb would do all his dances, make all his offerings, and 9.5 months later, when the new baby finally did come, Grubb knew for sure that of everything he tried, it was the alligator dance that had been the secret all along. He could tell by the baby's sharp teeth. And so every morning he would repeat the dance, hoping for Thak's stomach to rise once more. He would dance all day, and sometimes the dancing was good, and sometimes it was not. And when it was not, when he was sick and tired and frustrated from trying so hard and not succeeding, when there was nothing else left, he would return home where there was Thak, who did not want him to feel sad, and so offered Thok Thok. And sometimes, Thok Thok lasted well into the night.
I was walking down St. Catherine Street. I just got back in, and I'm a little overwhelmed. I just saw Lorne Greene outside, great Canadian actor, walking down St. Catherine Street.
Lorne Greene.
I don't really see celebrities every day. I'm a little overwhelmed.
Howard, Lorne Greene from Bonanza.
Yeah, how many Lorne Greens are there? Lorne Greene, beautiful mane of white hair, walking down the street. I was the only person that recognized him. I waved. He waved back. He was very respectful. I gave him his elbow room. The guy's earned it. But he knew that I knew he was Lorne Greene. And of course, he knew that he was Lorne Greene. And I knew that he knew he was Lorne Greene because he was Lorne Greene. Great. He looked great.
Lorne Greene, Howard, who died in the late 80s.
Well, he died like a celebrity death, like Johnny Carson's dead or you know, Janis Joplin's dead or whatever.
They're dead, Howard.
They're dead, but they're celebrity dead. It's not the same thing. It's not like a normal mortal human being who dies and gets buried and stuff.
Well, Howard, they're just as mortal as you were. Haven't you heard the expression, celebrities, they're just like you and me? That encompasses the fact that they die. They're of flesh and blood.
So you're saying to me that, like, Elvis is dead and Michael Jackson's dead and Tupac and all those.
They are very much dead, yes.
You're just so naive. I don't know what to tell you. These are celebrities. They don't die like normal people. They need to find a way to reintegrate into society, so there's a huge mechanism involved to fake their death. It's a ruthless world, you know, the celebrity world. I mean, it's just nonstop action. They have no privacy, you know.
So you think, so all these celebrities, they've all faked their deaths?
The vast majority.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear the little murmurs of so-and-so is still alive, and, you know, John Lennon's still alive, and Paul McCartney's still alive, and all that kind of stuff.
Paul McCartney is alive.
No, see, that's the irony. Paul McCartney's actually dead, and John Lennon wears Paul McCartney's face.
And where do you get this from?
You never heard, like, the quote people say, like, you know, so-and-so is dead, but they live on through their music.
Yeah, that's an expression. It's figurative. I mean, it means that, you know,
no.
We continue to enjoy their art.
No, they want you to think that it's figurative, but it's literal.
No, I think, Howard, it's art, you know, makes us, you know, immortal.
And that's the worst kind of immortality I can imagine, just to have your stuff resonate through the years. What does that mean? To be actually immortal, that's the goal. You know, the day after your alleged burial, you sit down, you have a big steak dinner, followed by a big fat cigar.
Okay, so then by your logic, if I'm a bit of a celebrity because of, you know, the radio show, that would make me immortal also.
What? No. You're going to die, and it's going to be like early, you know, like premature style.
Uh-huh.
You're not going to live forever, nor will your work.
Okay.
How are you going to be a celebrity? From what? Maybe you committed some kind of unpardonable crime or something, some horrible, awful crime. Kind of be like a celeb.
On Wiretap today, you heard Nelica Dager, Howard Chakowitz, and at the beginning of the show, you heard Emily Richmond, whose journey can be followed at bobbyroundstheworld.com. You also heard Steve Callahan, author of Adrift, 76 Days Lost at Sea. Wiretap is produced by Mira Birdwin-Tonic, Crystal Duhaime, and me, Jonathan Goldstein.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.